Welcome to Equestrian Movement's Best Do No Harm podcast. I'm your host, Katie Boniface, co-founder of Equestrian Movement with Sarah Gallagher. We work with horse riders who want to build a stronger bond and a deeper connection with their horses. In our first Do No Harm podcast, we discuss with other industry professionals how to work with horses to firstly do no harm and secondly support their mental, emotional and physical well-being throughout the training process, so that we have horses that enjoy learning and ask to be ridden. Each episode, we discuss the different influences our training can have and how we can improve our horses' overall athleticism, soundness of mind and body, and emotional fortitude, while strengthening and deepening our relationship with our horses. Each week, I will endeavour to bring to you a new episode on horse riding, training, handling and husbandry, or an interview with other industry professionals to help you address where and why you might get stuck in creating the beautiful union of dancing souls that is the equestrian sport. Are you ready to kick off today's show? Let's get started. Thank you for joining us for episode 2 with Andrew McLean from Equitation Science International. So excited to share this conversation with you as we delve into the work that equitation science does as an emerging field that explains why horses behave as they do, their biomechanical patterns and limitations, and on this template, how we can modify horse behavior. Explaining what is likely to work and what is unlikely to work in horse training and how we can communicate more effectively with horses. Andrew goes in to discuss how equitation science is not an ideology or a method, but rather a body of knowledge that provides evidence-based first principles that ensure safety, efficiency, best practice welfare, and ultimately sustainability. It informs all disciplines and ideologies of horse training and horse sports in a non-partisan way and privileges horse welfare as its top priority. I'm sure as you hear Andrew talk about his passion for the horses, you will hear all of this ringing true. Jump on the link in the show notes if you'd like to see the book that we reference, Modern Horse Training, Volume 1, First Principles. And if you get any aha moments or any little gems that you'd love to share with us, make sure you tag us over on Instagram. Without further ado, let's kick off today's show. So the next thing that I wanted to talk about, and I think it really does like circle into what we were speaking of about associative learning, is that the horses also have great context-specific memory, which is why we would, for example, teach the canter lead in the same corner every time to begin with before we can associate it to an aid.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same for Piaf. Any kind of thing you're teaching the horse, it always makes sense to be doing this in the same place each time before you move place, because we think we're teaching the horse Piaf or something like that, but the horse thinks he's learning Piaf with this person right in this area, and so that it does become part of it. So we've got to slowly dismantle it, and it's amazing how clever they are at that. There's just so many aspects of this context specific learning that we don't really account for because we're focused on the task. So that's really why when you start doing anything, you start in one part of an arena, and not only canter, but anything we do, we try to associate it with one particular place in one instance. Jumping is a good example. You know, you want to teach a horse to jump, so you first of all start with a really narrow set of things to jump. And then after a while, you can start to diversify it, because we think we've taught the horse to jump when he's jumped a rail on top of a 44-gallon drum, but then we turn around and jump a brush fence and he says, I don't do brush, because he's never done brush. And because they have such an amazing memory, what they do is what they see, they instantly compare it to what's stored, and if what is stored isn't in there or doesn't remotely look like it, they don't do it. So context-specific memory in horses is really amazing, and how they learn it is first of all because they have this incredible photographic memory, which I think in some respects we do, but it gets suppressed, as I said earlier, by the fact that we're constantly thinking of other things. And with the horse, it's so amazing that you know, they remember the bucket that was there outside the door or that wasn't there outside their stable. They remember after, even after years and going back to the same arena, if there's something different on the wall that wasn't there when they last saw it, when they last came there, they really noticed that. We've had horses that, I remember at the ABC and we had our fire equipment installed after the 2009 fires. We had a big reel on the wall and we have had other signs and things, and horses that had been there before absolutely noticed that thing on the wall and said, that's different.
Yes.
It's just because it's their nature. You know, if there are three rocks on the landscape, this path, and today there are four, it really pays to be suspicious. And so as we are training, what's worth remembering is the rule of five, because it takes, and this is not set in stone, this is an average. So it takes roughly five experiences of the same thing in order for them to start to generalize about something. So for example, I'll use the horse float as a good one. If a horse is just loaded into one horse float and we think that's good, we've taught the horse to load. And then the horse goes to the second horse float and says, no, I don't load in that. That's not the picture that I have stored of horse float. And so we teach him to load in that one. It's actually easier because the features are somewhat, there's someone there in the horse's brain for the horse to relate to. But nonetheless, it's generally a different picture. So it's easier to get him in that one. And the third one will be easier and the fourth easier. And generally on the five, they go, I do horse floats. And how that works is because in the brain, there's a phenomenon called an engram, which is a representation of a memory. And basically, when you have these five different horse floats, each one gets superimposed over the top of the other. So in the end, horse float just becomes that kind of shape that I will load into. But if he hasn't done enough, he won't. He'll still be in that early phase. Now, for some horse, it might take eight. And for another horse, they might go straight into the second one. But on average, it's five. Water jumps are exactly the same thing. You can't just go to the one-day event after doing just one water and expect he's going to launch into the water jump. Because for him, the water jump he learned had white railings around the edge and trees. And this one hasn't got that. And it's not, you know, say, for example, a hexagonal shape or something like that. So you get him to experience different waters in different places, and it gets easier and easier each time to get him there. But we don't expect he's going to, because that's how he forms his generalization of the engram. And by the fifth time in water, you can take him to the one-day event and you're pretty certain. And that's worked for me in my eventing. That was the credo I used. And it really worked well. So by the fifth, if he's done five waters, you can be pretty sure he's going to go into any water. But the rule of five is quite important. There is some experimental evidence for that too, using different shapes of the same kind of phenomenon and how long it takes. It's usually around about five that it takes for horses to habituate to that particular thing. And you can do the same with colour, anything that, you know. So it's worth thinking, if you're training horses to go anywhere or jump, to just think of the rule of five.
So good. When I was a kid, one of the cross country fences that was a water jump, they dyed blue.
Yeah, right.
Everybody fell off. Everybody got in there.
Yeah, horses are very good at blue and good at green. And good at yellow. Red, but they're good at those ones. They're good at all the colours of the natural landscape, and their vision's amazing because they don't really look at anything, but they look at everything. It's quite a weird thing. It's a bit like, I remember reading Jane Savoy's book, Ride With Your Mind, and she talks about having soft eyes. And horses have soft eyes all the time, in the sense that we focus on something and the rest of it's peripheral. The horse has the ability to see all of the horizon equally. And you know, he's not seeing much out the corner. He sees just as much there as he does in front of him. But his colour vision's not great. He's got the blue and the green and the yellow, but it's a little bit more like a dusk. And because he's a dichromat, not a trichromat like us and other primates, and birds are trichromats as well, like with the three colours, the red, green and blue. And that means he's got way better night vision. Horses see very well at night, but not so well in the as well in the daytime as say we do with the, you know, with in terms of acuity. We have much more visual acuity. They have sufficient to do their job, and but at nighttime it's amazing. When we're children on King Island, we'd be late home in the evening after chasing kangaroos along the Porky Beach, which was our nearest beach. We'd come home through the coast hills, and there were two fences to jump on the way home. And sometimes it was so dark, we'd just hang on to the mane and let the horse gallop home, and they finished up in our front yard in front of our house. And it was sort of fun when you're a teenager, but we couldn't see, and they were foot perfect. They're amazing how they see in the dark, but they're slow to adapt to dark. So if you go from a light stable to dark field, they take longer than we do. So we have to remember that too.
Yeah, there's always a lot of hesitation with that light change, even like going from the light into your indoor arenas and stuff like that.
Yeah, it makes a big difference.
Yeah. So I love how in this book you then go into, you know, you've talked about all of the learning and that kind of thing, and then you go into the regard for emotional states and the effect of stress on the body. Stress is one of my favorite topics. I think it's such an incredible thing. I don't know even how to start to describe why I love stress so much, but it's so beautiful in how it allows our body to protect ourselves and defend ourselves from threat. But then also that like a gentle stress is adaptive and allows us to perform better. And so when you're like talking about the different pressures and that kind of thing, it's important to be very aware of and in tune to the horse's stress response at the same time, so that we can make sure that they're actively learning and not just protecting themselves.
Yes, that's very true. And I think it is an important journey for us to really learn the signs of stress. And one of the things that has come out in recent years, in the last decade or so, actually it's been a bit longer than a decade, it's now two decades, about the facial grimace scale, you know, looking at the face and how it changes and the extra wrinkles in the eye when the horse is nervous, and the fact that you can maybe even see the white of the eye, which is really obvious, but the ears also go a little bit wider apart, and the chin and the bottom lip pulls back sometimes in stress. There are so many aspects. Our nostrils, often there's a wrinkle between them. There's so many aspects of this that it's really worth learning about it, because what amazes me is that when you look at a lot of the old textbooks that have pictures of horses on them, and even today some people put up pictures of horses that are actually clearly stressed, but nobody's noticing it so much. I guess when they put the picture up, they didn't seem to think so. And a recent study about affective states, you know, which is essentially the horse's like affect, you know, how it feels, and its nervous states, and that people are generally poor, like horse people, experienced horse people are generally poor at actually noticing affective states. They get some of them, but not all of them. So it's really a journey and something we should all learn, because partly horses conceal their pain.
Yep.
And they have to from predators. That's, you know, otherwise you'd be the first one attacked. And so because of that concealment, you've got to be quite good to and experienced to get to know what it is. But getting back to the stress itself, you pointed out very well too that the Yerkes-Dodson law about stress, that, you know, when stress gets too high, they can't learn, but if stress is too low, then they're not likely to learn either. So you need some sort of middle ground there of where it's at a really good state of arousal, but not too aroused to learn efficiently. And when stress levels do get higher, sometimes they'll peak a little bit higher than you would like in a learning of a task. Even in positive reinforcement, stress levels can do. And especially when horses start auto-shaping and all sorts of things like that, and they get really frustrated because there's some interesting papers on frustration and even disappointment in horses where something is withheld, the stress levels can rise. In the early stages of stress, that just shows up as an increase in heart rate, and the heart rate variability starts to decrease, you know, because in a normal heart, in a happy state, our hearts pitch and flow in a nice kind of way. But when we're really stressed, the heart rate variability decreases. So it's one of the interesting measures of stress. It's more accurate than just the raising of the heart rate. But nonetheless, as the heart rate goes up because adrenaline comes into the body, that can also go down quite quickly because adrenaline is very quickly metabolized. It's got a half-life of about 2 minutes, two and a half minutes. So in other words, it doesn't take long to get rid of your adrenaline and you're ready to learn again. So the half-life just means that this, after a certain period of time, only half of it is, you know, the adrenaline is left, and then, you know, again and again, so it diminishes. But cortisol starts to kick in if the adrenaline doesn't dissipate. So if an animal is stressed for too long, and I usually think that's something like 4 or 5 minutes, if it's going on for too long, and I wish I'd have known that because I was a culprit for doing that. But you do have to grow and learn. But if stress goes higher than 4 or 5 minutes and cortisol starts to kick in, now we've really got a problem on our hands because cortisol has a half-life of around 66 minutes and longer with heavier loads because cortisol can also attach to a globulin molecule and can be stored in that way and can also be liberated. So there's a big supply of cortisol. There's really no end to it. And it's about maintaining a really stressful body in order to solve a problem for the animal. And it usually involves, you know, hyperreactive states where the horse wants to gallop and run off. But after a period of time, it can also diminish into hyporeactive states where the horse now is shut down. And we've got to know those states. They're also part of the loss of, you know, the affective states and the loss of positive effect in the animal, positive affect in the animal. So it's worth just giving up at that point if the horse is showing high levels of cortisol because it won't learn and you're just going to embed the fear of the context. So best off to just, and I've done this in clinics and it's been super successful compared to what I used to do is just keep on going. And, you know, so most of the things that I am critical of trainers doing are things that I've done myself too. So I'm not coming from a righteous point of view. I'm saying, you know, we can all learn to be better. And so if the horse is getting too stressed, what I've done in my workshops, I did this a couple of years ago in Sweden, is that the horse was just so overwhelmed indoors. It was far too cold outside to do anything outdoors. So the horse was just overwhelmed. So I said, look, let's just teach him a little weeny thing. And we'll teach him to just step back from the bridle. And he did one step back. And I said, look, I'm sorry. We'll do the rest tomorrow. And it'll make a big difference tomorrow. And I think the owner felt maybe they'd paid this money for that. It was a short lesson. But the next day I was able to do a longer one because the horse came in so much calmer. But if I'd have really persisted with doing a whole lot more, like I would have done years ago, that wouldn't have worked. And I probably would have turned inside out, you know, gone backwards. So in a way, I think, as I said earlier, less is more, you know, to just, in a stressful environment, just teach something, the basis of something. And you'll find then if you go back in the afternoon, certainly need 3 or 4 hours off, or the next day, it will be a very different story and you'll have a much quieter horse. It is always amazing. And we do the same thing with elephants because elephants are very unforgiving when they're stressed. They usually get violent.
I can only begin to imagine. I think probably one of the hardest lessons of a rider to learn is to finish feeling like you could have done more. There's that persistent, like, oh, that was so good, I just want to do it again. Or I don't feel like I've ticked the boxes that I came in to achieve for today. And it's like our personal gratification and satisfaction of task achievement for the training session has to get left at the gate because we have to be just so respectful of the boundaries that the horses are setting for what they're capable of achieving with that day. We've got to say, like, this is what we're doing today is not for what I can achieve for today, but what I can achieve in the future in the coming weeks and months and years.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's so true. And I think it's easier when you get older to have that patience. And when you're young, you just want to get on and get things done. But it certainly works out like that. And I say that, you know, about when you're teaching the horse from the very beginning, from he's now newly started or broken in. But then, you know, you want to teach him to go further in dressage, for example. But you'd be best off to actually train him to do all of those basic things I mentioned, from the reins and legs, and coupled with good body position. So we need that, an eye on that all the time, because that can distort the aids. But let's assume the rider's riding perfectly. But just using the reins to be able to, when we close, I don't mean pull, I mean just close the fingers on the reins to achieve down gate transitions, shortening of the step, slowing of the step. So in other words, slowing the tempo, being able to step the horse backwards as well from halt, that's really a downward transition anyway, and turning the horse left and right from either direct or indirect rein, and also yielding the hindquarters from the leg, and also from the leg, training the horse to go up the gate faster and longer. All of those basic things, if we train the horse to do them well and we really consolidate it, so in any environment, wherever we go, he can do those things. He's got a really good shorter button. So it's not as simple as it sounds in some respects, because when you go shorter with the steps, often they go slower. So it's actually important to be able to pick that out and say, actually, I want shorter without slower. Or to say, I want slower steps without shorter. And it's just money in the bank teaching the young horse to do this at walk and be able to achieve all of those things, because at walk is about 55 beats per minute per leg. That means you've got time to notice when you use the aids, because the rein aids are best and the leg aids are used best at the beginning of a swing phase, not a stance phase. The horse is not listening in stance. So whenever there's a leg on the ground, you can't talk to it. But as it's leaving the ground, it suddenly hears you. And the reason for that is that the legs are taking the weight of the horse, are too busy and preoccupied with proprioception, you know, keeping the horse's body off the ground. But as soon as they leave the ground, you can talk to it. So say the left front leg is about to leave the ground, you can say with the rein, you can open your rein and say, now turn. And you can do that at the walk. It's hard at the trot because it goes faster. It's now 75 beats a minute. And it's harder again at the canter because it's 90 plus beats per minute. But at the walk, you can do that. So getting the feel, it's good for riders. It actually teaches them so much about timing, and it helps their body control. When you can get all of these things done, and we've avoided doing anything like travers or shoulder in or half pass or anything like that, or pirouettes, we don't need to do that because they're composites. They involve two or more of these basic things. You know, they'll involve a turn as well as a go, like a shoulder in, or a turn and a yield and a go, like travers and rollvers. So they're complicated. So we consolidate these things for 1.5 years, or maybe 1 year if you're good at it, and everything's working off light aids. And he does it not only here in your own arena, but he also does it at the show or at riding club or wherever you do it. When you then go and say, now I think I'll start my journey to do shoulder in, travers, pirouette, it'll be dead simple. He will do it immediately. He will know exactly what you mean when you say, okay, now bring your shoulders here, but put your hindquarters there. But you see, this is the equivalent to speaking to someone who's learning a language, suddenly blurting it out in the language rather than a single word at a time. And that's why it's important we have to speak to horses like that, one word at a time when they're learning. As they start to learn it, it becomes a learned response. In other words, it's just an automatic habit to the animal to respond to a rein or a leg signal, including with the couplings with the seat and all of those things that happen there, the consistency of that. And it doesn't always matter what you do with your seat, as long as what you do with your seat is the same way should you respond to the aid. There are good ways to use the seat, that's for sure, but it's really the consistency. And then you go and teach him all of these other things and it's a piece of cake. It'll happen straight away. And I've had so many pupils who've done it that way and have taken their time with the basics over the first year or year and a half. And then they said, right, now we're going to start movements, because movements are different to the other responses. Mm. I think it's, again, it's worth spending time getting the basics. As soon as you start doing things like half pass and other fancy movements, before the horse knows what you're talking about with the aids of the rein aids and the leg aids, you're suddenly developing something that is not good.
Yeah. Because
he's going to be, first of all, tense. You say, I don't even know the answer to the rein aids well enough, let alone telling me to do yield my hindquarters at the same time. So you've really got to think of it like that. And also to remember that all of these aids of the movements are a sequence. It's not a chord like in music. It's actually a sequence. So really, you can go rein and leg or leg and then rein, but one goes after the other. And the reason for that is when you're walking, you'll notice that, well, not all legs are in swing phase at the same time anyway. So if you want to turn the horse and then yield him, open your rein as the left front leg leaves the ground, but straight after the left front leg is the right hind. So you go, and now yield. But he can't yield when the front leg's leaving the ground unless he's in trot.
So good. There's so many important factors as a rider, even just like learning how to adjust the tempo with my seat took like so many years. I could not figure out how to get my seat to move independently of the horse. And so the horse always created my movement, and trying to get enough body awareness and self-control over my body to, like, you know, hang back in that stride a little bit to call the stride back. It took me so long just to even understand what I was trying to achieve, let alone to be able to apply it and coordinate it. And I think, you know, where we're spending that time in the walk is so critical. Like, I love the way that you teach, like, the layering and the scaffolding that's developed through the associative learning into these complex aids. You know, at the same time, we're spending the time with them learning and understanding the cue. We're building balance and coordination because we're laying down that myelination of the brain to talk to the muscles in the first place. And if we don't give our bodies and our horses' bodies the time and space to lay down that wiring to, like, move a part of our body consciously, then our body unconsciously takes over, and that's where we get, like, the bad habits where we might twist the wrong way or coordinate incorrectly and in a way that we can't move together as a team, and that's going to get ourselves stuck with progress as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In neurology, we call that long-term potentiation, you know, where you're developing habits. And it's interesting because when you first start developing habits in the horse or in a person, it's purely a nervous network you're dealing with. It, you know, you're strengthening it, and you're not only myelinating it, as you say, you're also adding blood vessels to supply more. That's why foals get really fatigued when you're teaching to lead, because there's just not enough oxygen and glucose going there to sustain it. So that's important to stop when they do look like they're fatiguing anyway, because that, you know, we don't want to overtrain it. But anyway, as time goes on and those pathways become consolidated, what a long-term memory is no longer just a nervous pathway. There's a kind of a bundle of real complex protein molecules called messenger RNA, basically, which are, because they're so complicated, they can represent billions of different memories because of the different sequences. So basically, long-term memories are formed by chemicals in the brain as a result of the neural firing of that particular pathway. And that takes around 3 months for consolidation, which is always interesting because there's so much wisdom in the horse world that people would say to me when I was young, that I remember racing people would say, you know, they learn best if you do 3 months on and 3 months off. And it was only in later in life I learned how that's actually pretty accurate. And 3 months might be a little bit long, but you're absolutely sure if you keep repeating that it's, you know, that it's really sort of set in stone there. And it's also, when it's a molecule and not just a nervous pathway, it's actually resistant to extinction. It's even resistant to trauma, chemical, electric shock even. It's quite amazing. Once they've got a, you know, that's why old people remember old memories from childhood, because they're encoded in these molecules, in these big protein molecules. And no matter what happens, they can have a stroke, but these things can come flooding back. And I remember my grandmother lived to be 106, and she wanted to read Ben-Hur when she was 103. And so she had to have a cataract operation, and they didn't want to do it, but she made them do it because they thought that she would die and they'd be, they made her sign an indemnity to do it. But anyway, when I went to see her in hospital after she'd woken up from the thing, she was singing nursery rhymes and was saying, "This is amazing. I haven't remembered this nursery rhyme since I was a child." And I said, "Well, how could you even know that you would remember it?" And she said, "No, I do. I know. It's just never been in my head since I was a child." So it is. And psychologists are always talking about those, you know, the flooding of long-term memories. I mean, some of them are so vile, memories that people have. You even shield them and you're not even aware of bad memories. So that's another level of trauma. But anyway, we don't have to go into that. But long-term memories are pretty rock solid and not always available to us consciously.
So good. Yeah, I just love the way that these like concepts can layer on top of each other and create that scaffolding to give us, you know, what we can do then as dressage competitors or other like show jumping and that kind of thing. And I do think that this kind of foundational stuff is very missed in a lot of kind of trainers' vocabularies and what they're teaching and whatnot, you know, especially if they haven't like done any breaking or anything themselves. It's like learning to start at the end instead of how we get the horse to that like viable product that allows us to sit on them and like, you know, push these buttons. I remember when I was a kid, I just like assumed that the horses would know how to respond to an aid. And then I started like doing breaking and training. I was like, oh, actually somebody has to teach them this and has to teach them as me. And so, you know, we need people teaching riders this, and we need riders to want to learn it as well and not just to want to sit on the horses and do the fancy movements.
Absolutely, yeah. It's interesting because at the very first conference I went to on animal behaviour, it was an international ethology conference in Italy, I was speaking to a guy who had given a talk about riding and he kind of alluded to the fact that it's really all to do with human body movements and that's what triggers the horse to go. And I said, that isn't really true. We went on a bus trip and I sat next to him, so I thought I'll have a chat to him about it. And said, you know, that's not really quite true. The horse learns to stop and go because somebody's used their legs and reins on that horse, not just their body. It's not just this beautiful synchrony that suddenly happens because the horse, you know, wants to please us. And it took me quite a while to convince him. So I said, have you ever broken in a horse? Because it's so fundamental. You learn that when you break in a horse. It doesn't know anything. It doesn't, you can move your seat and body. He has no clue, yeah. Nor does he care. Then why should he? And yet, you know, you start by teaching the horse the basics of stop and go. And often you do that. Stop, you can teach him heading into the corner of the yard because you can go, whoa, and the reins just before the corner comes up, and then he stops and you give the reins away and he goes, oh, it's either corners or slowing that makes the rein switch off. And very soon he learns it's actually just slowing, not just corners. Yeah, so it is important. And the other thing that it taught me was whenever you have problems, all you have to do is go back. By and large, of course, unless there are other issues of lameness and whatever, then you see the vet. But when you have training-associated problems and misunderstandings and evasions and all of those, you go back and you test those 10 basic responses, you know, up gate, down gate, longer, shorter, slower, all of that stuff, direct turn, indirect turn, yielding. You test those, absolutely guaranteed. And that's what I started to do in the last 20 years of my working life till now, is test those in hand and under saddle, and there are always failures.
100%.
And you fix those failures and your problems are pretty well gone. So you don't have to ride rearers to fix them necessarily. Often you've got to just go and repair the faulty stop and go on. Half the reason they rear is because people have got stop and go on at the same time when the pressures are too high.
Yeah.
And as I said, I've measured them in Europe using these rain tensiometry, and one that really stuck out to me, as I mentioned earlier, in Rotterdam, was where the pressures of the rains, we had a tensiometer and we had it in real time on a computer, and all the coaches who registered coaches in Netherlands who were there to watch it saw that the pressures for the rains, the bit in the mouth, peaked at 5 kilograms. And that's just absolutely ridiculous. That's not fair. And that's not what should ever happen. And you, if you can't do these cues at, you know, half, like at 500 grams max, then you're not a trainer. That's called wrestling.
Yes.
Equine wrestling.
Yeah.
When you cajole a horse with spur and pain and put him into this kind of frame. And this is the judge's fault. This is why I'm really tough on judges.
Yep.
They're the gatekeepers of horse welfare, and they're the ones who've allowed this crap to happen.
Yeah.
They really have to recognize self-carriage. If they can't see that this horse, when you release the reins, if they can't see that this horse will not stay in that outline, that tempo, that stride length, and that direction, if they can't imagine that, because any idiot can half the time, if they can't see that, they should not reward that horse. They're killing the sport. They're going to make it unsustainable, and they have to change. And if they change what they see, riders and trainers will change.
Yes.
Really, the criticism, I think, of all the current issues at the moment is, to me, the judges, and we're going to keep creating more of these young judges going to that area, talking this nonsense, the jargon they use, the throughness, the definition of throughness has changed dramatically. I can tell you exactly what it is, what it's meant to be. It's just meant to be that when the rein aids flow through to the back legs, in other words, if you give a half halt with a rein aid, a back leg should decelerate a little bit and sit. Now they use all sorts of fluffy. If I ask them commonly, what do you think throughness means? What do you think self-carriage means? What do you think rhythm means? And it's always different answers. That's wrong. In a sport, there should be the same answer for every person who judges it. Rhythm, you know, they don't barely know what rhythm is. They say, oh, the horse, you know, I see that it's in jumping lessons, when people are having lessons with sometimes top-level trainers, and they say, more rhythm. Well, what the hell does that mean? Do you mean he needs to be faster, like more tempo, or do you mean longer? Now, most likely, if it's a thoroughbred, it'll need to be longer because they already go quicker. If it's a warm blood, probably it'll already go longer, but it's not quick enough. You know, if you talk about rhythm, you need the rhythm to be slower. Do you mean it? You want it shorter or slower in the tempo? They're different things. We need to be much more precise about it. And while the whole sport remains blurry, and while you've got all this narrative surrounding it where people think it sounds smart, because often they're not very smart people always, and they want to make it sound like mathematics, that you can fool someone by looking like Einstein. It actually just is, it's foolish and unfair and unforgivable, to be honest, to be run narratives that are just simply a myth and untrue.
Thanks for joining us on today's show. Join us next week as we wrap up this conversation with Dr. Andrew McLean. All the links that you need to find his books, his resources, and other programs that he hosts online are linked up in the show notes below. If you've taken any aha moments or gems out of this conversation, make sure you share them with us and tag us over on Instagram. Let us know what you're loving about these conversations. Thanks for listening, and until next week, happy trails. If you're starting to realize that escalating pressure and having pressure release is the only tool in your toolkit inevitably results in conflict and manhandling your 500 kilo plus fur baby, you have to check out our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. There is an art and a science to everything we do with our horses. The science is the undeniable behavioral training and manipulation of the internal chemistry, neurotransmitters, and hormones. Hello, dopamine! The art is in the connection and the relationship. How your horse behaves is a reflection of who they are in relationship to you, how they receive your instruction, and how safe you make them feel to follow your lead. And if you didn't want that, ride a motorbike. We know that our horses are emotive, intelligent, sentient beings that are aware of the manipulative, coercive, and sometimes abusive tactics used to force them to cooperate. And we can seek a better way. The foundations of holistic horse handling are nervous system regulation, compassionate leadership, communication, and emotional agility. These elements are critical to have a handle on before going to work with your horse, so that we can develop the psychological safety for the horse to communicate how the training can be of benefit to them. Our training should be happening for them, not to them. If we want a horse that we can have trust and confidence in, and that seeks to look after us first, we need to create an environment where learning is fun, movement feels good, and our horse is asked to be ridden. This sounds impossible to you, know that it's not. It's a reality hundreds of our students have achieved. It just requires coming home and a relearning of what we lost due to peers, coaches, trainers, and other influences teaching us that that kind of softness and kindness creates unsafe horses. In truth, it is the opposite. To create safe, willing horses, we first need to create a felt sense of safety and a felt sense of belonging. We need to be strategic and intentional how we set the horse up for success, so as not to overface ourselves and our horses, and we need to create experiences where we build trust and confidence in each other. If you're ready for your horsemanship and horse riding to look like this, take the first step, click on the link in the show notes, and join us in our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. Or you can find it over on our website at www.equestrianmovement.com/sayyes. Until next week, happy trails.